morning. It's Saturday, September 20th, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, in Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, your host for Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a conversation with Philip Graham. Philip is the author of Interior Design, How to Read an Unwritten Language, The Art of the Knock, The Vanishings, and Parallel Worlds, An Anthropologist and a Writer Encounter Africa, co-authored with his wife, Alma Gottlieb. Philip and Alma are also in the process of preparing a second book about their Africa experience, Braided Worlds. His prose poems have appeared in the Paris Review, Virginia Quarterly Review, and elsewhere. His fiction has appeared in The New Yorker, North American Review, Carolina Review, Chicago Review, Crab Orchard Review, and numerous other journals. His essays have appeared in The New York Times, Chicago Tribune, and The Washington Post. He's been the recipient of grants and fellowships from the NEA, NEH, YADO, McDowell Colony, Illinois Arts Council, among others. Philip is director of the creative writing program at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and the fiction editor of the literary arts magazine Ninth Letter and is on faculty at the Vermont College of Fine Arts in Montpelier. Philip's dispatches from Lisbon, originally published on the McSweeney's website, are due to be published by the University of Chicago Press in September 2009. Because Philip was once a regular guest on a radio show about books, I began by asking him what first question he would ask Philip Graham if he were to interview him about his dispatches from Lisbon.
I would say, why did you go to Lisbon for a year?
Okay, that's my first question. Philip, why did you go
to Lisbon? Okay, all right. A couple reasons. One is, I discovered Portugal in the mid-90s. I can't say I ever gave Portugal much of a thought.
Uh-huh.
I heard some Portuguese music one day that really haunted me. And so I found myself listening more and more to Portuguese music and then discovering more about the culture and starting to read the literature as well. And I think the thing that I began to understand that attracted me to the culture was this untranslatable Portuguese word called saudade.
Saudade
is a combination of nostalgia and longing and regret and sadness and hope and beauty and so forth. And I would have to say I learned a lot of saudade while I was living in Portugal. But I think the reason why saudade hit me when Portugal came to my attention in the mid-90s to late-90s was, I think, and this is only after a lot of thinking, my parents died in 1993 and 94 in ways that I would have to say were psychologically unfinished. I had great regrets over things said and over things left unsaid in both those relationships.
Mm.
And I think I was suffering from saudade without knowing the word. Finding Portuguese culture, which sort of revels in that sense of saudade in almost everyday life, made me feel as if this was some place where I needed to be.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, my family went on a couple trips to Portugal, and then after a certain point we decided that when we had an opportunity to leave the country for a year that's where we would go.
And this was a sabbatical for you?
A sabbatical combined with a grant to write a book.
Okay.
And that was sabbatical for both my wife and I, and also it was a grant we both received to write a book that we were writing together.
And that was the book on Africa?
A sequel to our book on Africa, yeah.
And now you mentioned a novel that you were also working on.
Also working on a novel. Writing the dispatches was like an afterthought. It was only about a month or so before I went that I wrote to the editor of McSweeney's, where these mm-hmm. Dispatches appear, because I really admired the work of Roy Kesey, who writes dispatches from China. And I thought, well, I'm going to Lisbon for a year. Maybe I could do this. You know, maybe it would be something I could do in between everything else. And so I wrote and said, are you interested? And they said, sure, send us a couple and we'll see what we can do.
Now, see, that was my next question. How does one approach a publication like McSweeney's?
Just did that, you know.
Yeah. You write fiction mm-hmm. and creative nonfiction.
Mm-hmm.
Do you find it easier to write about your own experiences or to write from the perspective of fictional characters?
I would have to say it depends upon my mood at the time, mm-hmm. you know. It's very interesting. The book that my wife and I are writing is a sequel to a book we wrote called Parallel Worlds, and publisher asked us to write the sequel. This book is going to be about returning to the villages that we lived in for several years off and on, and this is the time we took our son, who was 6 years old at the time. Mm. And so it becomes very complicated. It really becomes a story about family as well as the villagers in Africa and so forth. And we're writing that still as while I'm writing these dispatches. And these dispatches became quite clear to me was, though it's all about Portugal and it's about our family, the main thread through it is the experience of my daughter, mm-hmm. who actually had a more intense experience of Portugal than we did because she went to a Portuguese school. Mm-hmm. And so I'm finding myself writing at this moment two nonfiction books, and in each case they're concentrating on one of my children. And it's a kind of an odd feeling, you know. Mm-hmm. In one case, recreating a very recent series of events in my daughter's life, and in the other, the six-year-old incarnation of my now 21-year-old son. So that's a lot of distance there,
right.
And funny to see him how he was since I know him so intensely and who he is now. But I would say that. Having almost fortuitously found myself in this situation where I'm writing so intensely about family, I'm quite enjoying it. And so even though I have a novel that I'm working on, I'm really putting that on hold until I sort of complete these family narratives, which seem to be where I need to be at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
But when I'm writing a novel, it is intensely personal, and I would have to say that all the characters that one creates are, you know, subtle aspects of who you are anyway. You're just sort of giving, you're putting a face and a name that's different from yours, or a potentiality of who you might be onto somebody else on a fictional character. And I'll be ready to go back to that when it's time.
Mm-hmm. How does your family feel about being represented in the creative nonfiction that you write?
I think they like it. My daughter doesn't talk much about it, but she does read them and approve of them, you know. Same with my wife. My son also. When I was writing about him and his fiancée when they were visiting us in one of the dispatches, I wanted to let him know that some of the things I was going to say weren't exactly complimentary, you know, that there was one point where I felt I needed to pay more attention to Hannah during the car trip, and he said, that's okay, say whatever you want, we can handle it, you know. But it's all with love, because I love all the people in my dispatches, so I'm pretty hard on myself, so I think if anything, you should ask me, am I upset with me writing about myself that way, in which I would say, sometimes I'm pretty upset with Philip Graham, he invites my privacy too often.
Yeah. Well, you're a little self-deprecating.
Just a little. Well, let's say I'm hyper-aware of my fallibilities, especially when you're in another culture. You're very much aware of that. You're very much aware of the mistakes you make.
I enjoyed how much you and Alma, your
mm-hmm.
wife,
yes.
celebrate Hannah's successes
yeah.
in language mm-hmm. And in her cultural education. And accept her criticisms of your own failings. I thought that was a kind way to react to
yeah.
that. One of my favorite dispatches is 365 Days of Pork Surprise.
Okay.
I have friends who won't eat pork.
Yes.
And I can appreciate how difficult it would be to live in such a pork-dependent culture.
It is pork-dependent. That's a very good way of putting it. Yes.
But what I really love about this dispatch from a writer's perspective is a refrain that you employ at least twice.
Yeah.
In the dispatch, your wife, Alma, who doesn't eat pork, has mm-hmm. been fed it by you unintentionally.
Yes.
And you say, I can't tell Alma this ever. I'll never tell her. And the fact that she will read the dispatch is left unexplained,
yeah.
obvious. And that makes it really hilarious. And it's like this little aside to the reader that supposedly is like a confidence to the reader. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about this as a device. Why is this so funny? And I just loved that. It was great.
Well, I mean, the joke is after I say, I can't ever tell her, ever, I'll never tell her, new paragraph. I tell her.
Right. So that was
because
great.
I can't keep a secret. That's just me, you know. And I think it's, you know, I mean, I think a lot of people who, you know, have made a big boo-boo. What I did was I bought some Alieta sausage. And Alieta sausage actually has a very interesting history. They were invented by Portuguese Jews who were hiding the fact that they were Jews because it was during the forced conversion and it was during the early days of the Inquisition and so forth. And so they figured out how to make sausage that looked like it had pork in it and tasted like it had pork in it, but in fact had rabbit and goat or whatever it might be that could disguise the identity. In other words, you could eat sausage publicly and people would not suspect that you were Jewish. It was a kind of a cover, you know. And Al Yiddish is a very popular form of sausage right now, but it somehow has lost its initial historical imperative, so that you cannot find Al Yiddish anywhere in Lisbon, at least, or most of Portugal, with that doesn't have pork in it. So it's like a complete, you know, it's a complete misnomer to call these sausages Al Yiddish. The whole point of them was not to have pork in it. And so I just bought them sight unseen, didn't look at the ingredients, thinking, oh, Alma would be so happy to have these. It's an interesting historical point, you know, and she can eat sausage without having to worry about pork. And then I'm looking later as I'm cooking the meal, and there's the pork in it, and Alma comes in at that moment and starts to take a bite before I can say anything, and I'm stuck, you know. So I try to pretend that it's... I'm not feeding her pork, and she's complimenting the meal all throughout the meal, and I'm feeling more and more like a cad, and decide I'll never tell her, and then, of course, I have to tell her.
But I think that's part of the charm of these dispatches, is they are so human, and, you know, everybody can relate to your position and her position.
I think it's because when you are living abroad, you're greatly aware of your frailties as a human being. You know, all the problems that you have get magnified in some sense in another culture, or you're at least hyper aware of who you are as a person because you're cast in relief with a landscape that's not completely familiar.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a great self-consciousness, I think, that comes from travel, and that creates, you know, interesting moments in a family, because everybody's going through that at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then you use that refrain again at the very end to refer to a hypothesis you've heard.
Of course, which I, in fact, then told her.
Well,
I can read that. I remember reading years ago that there are no true vegetarians, since the air we breathe is filled with microscopic particles of dust, pollen, bits of dead insects, and if you're walking anywhere near a McDonald's, microscopic morsels of hamburger. And if this is true, imagine what various pork products must drift through the air currents of Lisbon. But I can't tell Alma this, ever. I'll never tell her. Which means, of course, since I betrayed that the first time, of course I'm going to tell her, you know, and ruin her whole year thinking that she's inhaling pork products, you know. I can't help myself.
Well, this might be a good time for you to read something from the work.
Okay.
This is Philip Graham reading from his Dispatches from Lisbon, which have been published in periodical form in the McSweeney's online.
All right, this is a piece from the dispatch called The Moon Come to Earth, and it's about my daughter and I traveling through a large part of downtown Lisbon following a number of public art exhibits dealing with light, and it's nighttime, and we're going there and going from one to the other, and so many people in Lisbon are walking back and forth in the streets following this course to see the various artworks, and here we are. Dad, look, Hannah's saying, and I stop and stare. We've come upon a Ben and Jerry's, of all places. We are instantly their latest customers. After choosing a cone stacked with chocolate, Hannah insists that we sit in a corner away from the crowd. And for her, I guess this minor anonymity hits the spot as much as the ice cream does. Shyness has always been an alien concept for my daughter, but her role as a North Americana object of intense curiosity in her school must surely be tiring. So I can't help myself. I wind up my mantra that this year will end up being an extraordinary experience for her, and Hannah can only stare at me. As far as she's concerned, the jury's still out on Portugal. I shut up and enjoy the ice cream, though I can't help silently wishing that my daughter's task were as easy as catching a bird on a wing or a cloud across the moon, as she tried to photograph earlier today. Despite the unexpected windfall of American-style ice cream, our evening has been long on walking and short on inspiration. Still, we continue down the hill into the Chiado neighborhood in search of the festival's next installation. A turn here, a turn there, and we find Loon, a huge sphere sitting in the corner of a recessed plaza, made of some sort of durable white canvas. It's lit from within, like a giant light bulb, and across its surface are painted sketches of lunar craters and mountain ranges. More than a few of the people passing by stage goofy poses before it, casting themselves as temporary stars of their own remake of E.T. Perking up, Hannah murmurs, "So pretty. The moon, it appears, has come to Earth tonight, magically just for her. And even if it has left the shifting clouds behind, Hannah radiates concentration and lines up her shots. I decide to give her all the time she needs, suspecting that my daughter must feel some kinship with this fallen moon. After all, they're fellow travelers, taken out of context and isolated. I lean back on a stone bench and marvel at just how private public art can be. Alma and I have always dragged our children along with us over hill and dale, a family ethos we've never really thought to question. But tonight, watching Hannah take tentative steps toward the moon for a close-up of the craters and ridges, I can't help doubting myself. She takes one last photo. "Goodbye," she says wistfully. Then Hannah turns and half smiles at me across the plaza, a sad and dreamy expression that almost breaks my heart. With a step, my daughter pulls away from her moon, and if I were a better father, this would be a perfect moment to call it quits and return to the apartment.
Thank you very much.
Welcome.
Were you witness to or victim of any prejudice there, anti-foreigner, anti-American?
I would say no. I mean, I was worried about being an American because Americans aren't so popular these days. But, you know, it's funny. I would have to say that part of the reason why we went abroad for the year that we had off from teaching, my wife and I, is basically to get away from the Bush presidency for 1 year, to have a little break from the misery of this awful regime. And what we found when we went to Portugal was that you cannot escape American culture in many places in the world. I mean, all the television, a great majority of the television shows are from the United States. I would say 80 to 90% of the movies that appear in the movie theaters are from the United States. It really goes through the culture. There's a great admiration for an American culture and music and art and so on and so forth. So I found myself railing against America sometimes. I mean, about, you know, the things I didn't like culturally about my country, and in particular the political situation with George Bush. And I found my Portuguese friends not necessarily disagreeing with me, but trying to make me see the sunny side of life. You know, "Oh, he'll be gone soon, don't worry," or whatever. I mean, they kind of felt sorry for me, you know.
Right.
So we never felt that kind of prejudice. And my wife is Jewish, and she was very much aware of sort of not so much anti-Semitic currents in Portugal as just a complete lack of understanding that a great deal of Portuguese history has been formed by Jewish culture, and that in fact so many people who don't think of themselves as Jewish are in fact Jewish because of their last names identify them as such. When the Jews converted to Christianity, or were forced to convert to Christianity 500 years ago, those who didn't go underground took names like Oliveira, olive tree, Pereira, pear tree, Coelho, rabbit, and so on and so forth. They took on names that weren't Christian names, but that weren't Jewish names. And you look at the phone book, and there's zillions of those people. I mean, there's been an enormous amount of intermarriage between, you know, Portuguese people and Jewish Portuguese people without anybody really knowing that that was happening, because it's been 500 years since the forced conversions. And a lot of that sort of thing has been erased. But my wife was very, very much aware of it. In fact, some of the research that she ended up doing when we were there was doing research with Cape Verdeans, who are the citizens of an African island nation, about 9 islands off the coast of Senegal. That was a former Portuguese colony. And she met people there who are still proud of their Jewish heritage. A lot of people... Jewish Portuguese left in the late 15th century, went to these very isolated African islands, and to hide from the Inquisition, and then intermarried, you know, with the Africans who were also sent there because they were deserted islands initially, and now this is beautiful, magnificent Creole country there that's really quite wonderful, a very interesting mix of African and European culture, like nowhere else in Africa, and so those are the people that she's studying.
Yeah, it's amazing how people got sent off to these supposedly horrible places that have turned out to be paradise, you know.
Yeah,
Australia,
yeah.
It's like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
you are a teacher and you've been an editor of creative nonfiction.
Yeah. Fiction.
And fiction. Yeah. Is Ninth...
I took a break for 2 years, but now I'm back as the editor, the fiction editor of Ninth Letter.
Ninth Letter. And yes. You co-founded that, correct?
Yes, I was the co-founder.
Okay. So I just want to know, what mistakes do you see people making in writing about their own lives and submitting to magazines?
Well, I think you have to be humble if you're writing about your own life. You know, you can't expect that every single thing you've ever done is interesting. I think that when you write about any subject, you have to be very careful about what you include and what you don't include, you know. And you also have to be engaged in the material. I mean, I found myself so excited to be in Lisbon. I was so happy to be there. Mm-hmm. That the dispatches were initially an attempt to recreate that excitement. And I think if you were enthusiastic about what you're writing about in any way, not just enthusiastic, like, boy, I'm really happy about this, but I'm really torn by this or whatever, then I think a reader will find that emotion inside themselves. I don't think readers read the work of writers. Well, of course we read for difference and to understand other things about the world, but we're also always looking for the connection of what is like. Why is this person who's different from me actually like me? What is the passion of this person that brings up a passion that I have, that I haven't expressed, a passion that I'm afraid of, a fear that I have that's being spoken about, that I've not spoken about myself? I think when you're writing fiction or nonfiction, that if you're uncovering something in a reader who, of course, you don't know, that is an uncovering that person needs to have uncovered, is asking for an opportunity to have uncovered, then you have a genuine emotional connection between the work of the reader and the writer.
Do you think about your readers as you're writing?
All the time. For clarity's sake, I want to make sure that they can see what I'm seeing and they can feel some approximation of what I'm trying to express in my feelings. All sorts of ways in which I feel that there's someone over my shoulder. Now, I have to say that when I was a younger writer, I always felt that audience looking over my shoulder was kind of mean and oppressive, you know, kind of, you better get that right, you know. Yeah. What did you do that for? And now I just feel them as kind of a friendly, for friendly old acquaintances, that all they want me to do is to write well enough for them to understand what I'm trying to get across, and that they're forgiving of me in my early drafts. When you're a writer, you have to be very mean to yourself. You have to be very demanding. You have to say, you know, you cannot get slack here. You have to examine this. You have to fix that metaphor. You have to do all these things. You have to be mean to yourself. Meaner, perhaps, to yourself as a writer than you would ever be, say, if you were participating in a writing workshop with another writer.
Right.
But you will die if that's only what you're doing. You also have to find compassion for yourself and forgiveness for yourself so that when you make mistakes, so that when the paragraph or the scene is not perfectly shaped, if the dialogue is a little bit off or whatever it might be, you have to say to yourself, that's okay, good try, let's start again.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think you have to have both real rigor and a real asking of high standards for yourself and forgiveness when you don't immediately meet them.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to publication is so hard these days, and it's, I think, from what I've seen, sometimes so irrelevant from quality. I mean, I know of manuscripts that are out there by friends of mine and former students that absolutely deserve publication, and then I see stuff that gets published and even praised that is, I think, absolute dreck. You know, and I'm not talking about the usual dreck that would be easy targets, but, you know, some literary fiction that gets a high profile and I don't think is nearly as good as stuff that I see that's not getting published. So mm-hmm. I think you just simply have to have faith in yourself and realize that if you keep trying, if you keep sending the work out, and it really was the case with me, and it is the case with so many people, that you, if you've written something that you feel is genuine and is close to your heart and that can potentially be close to the heart of a future reader, then it will find a place.
Mm-hmm. Well, my last question
okay. Is
always the same
yeah. For
authors.
Okay.
For writers who might be listening, do you have any exercise or activity that you turn to when you're stuck in your work or a piece of writing refuses to move forward for you?
There are a couple things. One is taking walks. I found that walks are very, very good. And in fact, my wife and I walking together, you know, when we get kind of tired of writing, you know, this book that we're working on, taking walks gets us sort of out of that office cloistered feeling, and often we talk about the work that we're doing, and it often brings us some breakthroughs. So for that particular book, that walks are very helpful. But for me, for my fiction or just my own particular nonfiction, like these Lisbon Dispatches, I listen to music. And I always have listened to music. You know, some people say, I cannot write with music. And sometimes I can't as well, but I almost always need music to get me started. And then sometimes I can keep listening to music while I'm in the flow of things. For the Dispatches, I've been listening to a lot of Portuguese music, and it's not just fado. There's a great jazz tradition in Portugal, and rock tradition and folk tradition in Portugal, and there's some glorious music there that no one ever hears about. And I found that when I put that music on, it brings me back to Lisbon in a very visceral way, in a way that nothing else does. Mm-hmm. That helps me open up, you know, the memory ducts for whatever particular aspect of Portuguese culture and our adventures in it that I'm trying to evoke.
The song that you've talked to me about,
yes,
is called
On the Other Side of the Ocean.
Okay, and how do you say it in Portuguese?
Do Lado do Sá do Mar by Mario Lajinha.
Okay. Yeah.
The reason why I like this particular song, which I play on a loop over and over and over again sometimes when I'm in the mood, is that it seems, though it's a jazz piece, to really exemplify the saudade, the feeling of saudade that you hear in the traditional fado music of Portuguese music. And there's a modal melody, and you can feel the melancholy of it, and there's something elusive about it, or there's something very sad, and yet something that's so beautiful about the melody that it just gives me chills every time I listen to it. And the year that we had in Lisbon was a beautiful year, but it was also a very difficult year in many ways, in terms of accommodating another culture and our family making it through being away from home and so forth, and especially the challenge that my daughter had in her Portuguese school, and which he did brilliantly in, but it was also hard. And so when you add all that together, and sometimes this 5-minute piece, it sounds like the soundtrack of our year to me, and I just play it over and over again, and it speaks in ways that I can't speak in words of what it was like to be there.
Mm-hmm. It almost sounds like that word, saudade, speaks something to you like this music speaks.
Yes, yes, very much so.
That we can't put into other words in English right now.
Yeah, yeah, so. It's a good Portuguese word that everybody should know.
Well, you're a writer, you should come up with a word in English for this word.
No, I'll work on it.
All right. Well, Philip, thank you so much for talking
with
me.
That was great. Thank you so much for inviting me. Yes, it's been very, very nice.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Philip Graham. Next week, Write the Book will be on a brief hiatus. The show will be back October 4th with an interview of the poet Rick Jackson. I should mention that the views expressed on Write the Book are solely those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of WOMMLP, its management board, or any of its affiliates. Here's the Bookworm's calendar for this week. UVM Professor Hilary Neroni will moderate a discussion of the graphic novels Mouse 1 and 2 at the South Burlington Community Library on Tuesday, September 23rd at 7. This is part of the Let's Talk About It, Jewish Literature, Identity, and Imagination series. Local author Tracy Campbell Pearson will talk about being a writer and an illustrator, and will autograph books at the South Burlington Community Library on Wednesday, September 24th at 3:30. For more information or to register, call the library at 652-7080. Naomi Miller will facilitate a discussion of The Birth of Venus by Sarah Dumont at the South Burlington Community Library on Thursday, September 25th at 7. If you're interested in sharing Write the Book with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live every Saturday morning at www.theradiator.org. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes as free podcasts. If you have comments about the show or events for next week's Bookworm's calendar, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. Stay tuned. Hike Bedrosian is up next. Today I'm closing the show out with Philip Graham's favorite Portuguese jazz piece, On This Side of the Ocean, Do Lado de Sá do Mar by Mario Lajinha. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, in Burlington, Vermont.